So, hello, everyone. I'm glad to be here with all of you during Ruhatsu Sesshin. In case you don't know me, I am Tendo Shoryu Christopher Leader. I am the most recent former Shuso for all beings and Sangha. I was Shuso in the time of COVID part one. And I'm happy to still, to be here with you guys a year later in the same session where we can all sit together. In putting this talk together, I think a lot of my talks, I start off in kind of one direction and it sort of meanders back and forth until I hone in on where I want to be. So I'm going to cover, I think, some ground that probably most of you are familiar with, and then hopefully with kind of a different look at it at the end. So if you'd bear with me, I hope that this will be interesting for you. One thing I did want to mention is that I'm going to quote and tell stories from some sutta, and on the technical side of things, the Mahayana tradition that Soto Zen descends from is a little bit at odds with some of the other traditions over what the core sutras are and how they're presented and things like that. So if you went to look up the stories that I'm going to tell later, a lot of times you'll see them listed as in the, I'm going to butcher these words, but just hold on with me. The Dhammakakapatavana Sutra. It's like this long. But that's for the Theravada and some of the other traditions. Mahayana uses the Lalitavistara Sutra. So that's what I'm going to be quoting from. So if you go back to find specifics from this, it is in the Lalitavistara Sutra. So starting off, I'm sure that everybody here before has heard the story of how the Buddha came to be enlightened. Again, I kind of wanted to put all this together to kind of form this picture that we're going to look at the end. So we all know that he was born the son of a politician living in a wealthy area where he was sheltered from the realities of the world that he lived in. And as some of the early texts suggest, actually sheltered from all of the religious traditions of the area. So without exposure to that or the world at large. And some number of years later, of course, he leaves his home and walks among the people and discovers sickness and disease and decay and death, and realizes at some point that his body is subject to all of these same issues and that everyone is subject to all of these same issues. And so he leaves his home, home city, he leaves his home state in search of something that could purify this suffering for him. So in the beginning, he tried becoming a mendicant. He studied with a couple of yogic teachers. Interestingly, one who taught the way of finding nothingness and one who taught the way of going between perception and non-perception, which would obviously be important in how he develops. So he taught with these two yogic teachers, and both times he mastered their arts. He studied with them for long enough that they said to him, Siddhartha, please come and join our community as a teacher. Please stay with us and help spread my teachings. He said to them, no, this is, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. So I'm going to leave in search of that. And so he moves on to the second yogic teacher and the same thing happens. Siddhartha, please stay with us, help us spread our teachings. And he says, no, this still, I haven't found a way out of suffering yet. So he leaves, and he leaves these traditions behind. And he turns to an ascetic practice, which is a practice, one of the main features of it anyways, is largely of deprivation. You do things like very intense meditation. The ascetic practice that he was in did a forced kind of focus concentration. You concentrate on one thing for hours and hours at a time. And another important part of it was eating as little as possible, just the bare minimum to keep you alive. And so as he's going through this practice of denial and forceful control of the mind, he's literally wasting away. And some of you may have seen the famous statue of him where he's in a meditation position and you can see all of the bones through his ribs and his hips and his arms. The sutras say that's where he was at this point. He was completely emaciated, unable to really move or care for himself. And he realized that even such intense deprivation hadn't brought him to the end of suffering. So in this practice, the thing that he'd gleaned from it was that there was something to this idea of sitting and not doing anything. There was something to this idea of concentrating, maybe that he linked back with his yogic practice. And he realizes that there is, that the practice of meditation is going to be key to him, but that there has to be some way between the largesses of the way that he was brought up and the deprivation of the ascetics, which would become the middle way. So he goes to the ascetics that he was practicing with. There were five of them. When he goes to him and he says, hey, I think I've got something figured out and it's not going to involve you. And so they were actually really upset with him and they cast him out for, they thought that he was just being lazy or that he couldn't control his hunger. And so he was leaving the teachings that they thought were the way to, the key to everything. The key, an important factor to them was long life. And so they thought he was leaving all of this. So they cast him out and left him on his own. And there's a neat story in here about how, you know, a girl from the village fed him porridge and he was revitalized and he comes to sit under the pina tree where he meditated for a long period. Peepul tree. He sat down like determined to dig into this idea that he'd had about this intersection between meditation and the middle way and how this was all going to fit together. So he meditates for a long time and there's have been literally entire books written about the period that he spent in meditation. So I'm going to kind of gloss over that and move on to where he stands up from under the, or rather from where he ends his meditation under the peepul tree. And he, at this point, has awakened and is sitting there under the tree going kind of, what now? and so he argues with himself over whether or not he should spread this teaching. Not just how he should spread this teaching, but whether or not he should spread the teaching at all. So he is with the metaphorical keys to the kingdom, trying to determine if there's even a way to help other people understand this. And so he thinks to himself, and this is where I'm gonna quote a little bit from the Lalitavastara Sutra. He thinks to himself, profound, peaceful, stainless, lucid, and unconditioned. Such is the nectar-like truth that I have realized. Were I to teach it, no one would understand, so I will silently remain in the forest. So he knew that this was a complicated thing to teach in the sense that it was so different from what was being taught in his day. He was worried that people wouldn't trust him or wouldn't believe him. Or at one point in the discussion that comes, he says basically like, they're going to argue with me and it's going to be exhausting. And so I'm just not going to. And so he's having this argument in his head. And according to the sutra, the Brahma, all of the gods in the realm, the Brahma hear him having this internal argument. And all 6,800,000 of them descend on the Buddha to beg him to bring these teachings to the world. So he's hesitant. So these 6 million Brahma go and get a bunch of other gods and bring them back. And they all beg the Buddha. And they say, please, please go do this. And so here he is sitting there, this man who's just recently become enlightened, with all the gods of the realm, all the great listeners, all the great beings, all the Brahma circled around him, begging them. And they're all kind of be like, you know, hey, look, we really like you to go share this. And so after a number of exchanges back and forth with these gods, he says to them, whether I teach the Dharma or not, this group that is sure to be wrong will not understand the Dharma. And whether I teach the Dharma or not, this group that is sure to be correct will understand the Dharma. Yet the group that is undetermined will understand the Dharma if I teach it, but will not understand the Dharma if I do not teach it. And the Brahma and the gods surrounding him at this point realized that he was acquiescing to their requests. That he had agreed to go forth into the world and teach those that were undetermined and in need of the Dharma. So they kind of set him out. They're all happy. They celebrate. Okay, great. You're going to go do this thing. And then they kind of leave him under the tree to figure out the logistics of it on his own. So he still has all of these, the same, even though he's been convinced that he has to share this Dharma with the world, he still has all of these same kind of reservations that he began with, right? This sort of, who's going to understand this? Like, who's going to be like worth hearing it? So he sits under the tree, under this tree, and he reaches out his senses across the world, and he says, who should I teach this to? To whom should I teach this Dharma for the very first time? Who is pure, kind-hearted, easy to train, and a good teacher, able to purify others? Who has little desire, anger, and delusion? And he's thinking about all the people of the world, and I'm reading this, and all I can think to myself is, well, I'm really glad that those restrictions have kind of lifted in the last 2,000 years, because I would not have made the cut for that first round. And that's kind of the thing, right? He's looking for somebody that has all of these great qualities that will understand this entirely novel concept and be able to share it with the rest of the world. So he realizes that there was someone that he knew that he could go back to. And he settles on of all the people that he had met in his travels and having left the palace, he settles on one person, Rudraka, son of Rama. And he, as the name comes to him, he thinks, Rudraka is pure and kind-hearted. It is easy for him to make others understand and purify them. He has only little desire, anger, or delusion. He is open-minded, but now suffers because he has not heard the Dharma. He instructs his students in the practice of disciplined conduct that leads to a state of mind that is neither conscious nor unconscious. And so Rudraka filled the requirements that he basically laid out in the beginning. And the moment that he settles on Rudraka, his senses return the information to him that Rudraka has actually passed away a week ago. And so the Buddha grieves for a moment for his lost friend who hadn't had the opportunity to learn the Dharma. He had suffered and died without ever coming to know this. But he still needs a student. So he goes back to his list and he thinks about who else he might know. And he settles on someone named Arada Kalama, who again, met the very similar criteria, perhaps not as well as Rudraka, but very similar criteria. So the Buddha sends out his senses to try and locate Arada so that he can go to him and teach him. And he's struck back by the same feeling. Arada has died just 3 days past. And so the Buddha grieves for his friend who has suffered for not knowing the Dharma and died without ever learning the Dharma. But he still needs a student. So now he's struck out twice. And he reaches out in search for someone to teach the Dharma to. And I don't know, maybe trying to pad his odds a little bit, he settles on a group of people. The five arhats that he had trained with, or I'm sorry, not the five, but the five ascetics that he had trained with originally. So he believed that these ascetics could understand the Dharma because they have already practiced and they already possess pure qualities of accomplished scholars. They are intent on the path to liberation and are free from obstructing forces. So we've gone from this big list, and to be clear, he goes on to say that, you know, they share many of these qualities, but they've gone from this big list to, okay, well, there's a group of people that are really good teachers, they're really dedicated, and I'm pretty sure they'll understand all of this. So having settled on this group of students that he's going to teach, he stands up from under the pipal tree that we now know as the Bodhi tree and starts his journey. And so there's a neat little kind of travel montage as he goes back to the forest where he studied with the ascetics. And there's kind of a cool story in there where, you know, he's just been awakened. He has all of this power, and he comes to a river, and he goes to the ferryman to get across the river. And the ferryman says, you know, there's a cost for it. And he says, well, you know, I've been an ascetic. I have no money. And the ferryman says, well, the king, I can't take you across. The king insists that I charge you. And so the Buddha looks at him and levitates his way across the river and then just continues his walk. And so just like leaving the ferryman there. And I don't know, that's, for me, that's a really kind of funny image. Just like, all right, well, fine. Like, so as he continues his journey, and he goes back to where he studied with these ascetics, is in a location called Deer Park. And this is, again, if you looked up these sutra that I discussed earlier, a lot of times you'll find it referred to as the Deer Park Sermon. So he returns to Deer Park, where these ascetics are still living. And as a reminder, they all believe that he's abandoned the path to knowledge. They believe that he is, that he's done so because he's weak. So as he gets closer to Deer Park, they see him coming. And so they say, they talk amongst themselves and they say, oh, here comes gluttonous, lazy Siddhartha, or gluttonous Lady Gautama. Don't help him at all. Don't hold his alms bowl. Don't hold his robe. Like, oh, well, maybe we'll give him a place to sit just so he can see how great we are. But don't help him at all. So they arrange these stumps and they sit down and they wait on the Buddha to draw closer and closer. And as he does, they're kind of all sitting there in this sort of like, you know, we're going to show you how good we are now. And he gets closer and closer and they become more and more unsettled. And they're seeing how radiant he is and how the sutra talks about how they can feel the pressure coming off of him from his enlightenment, and it unsettles them. I think that the phrase used in the sutra is like a bird above a flame with nowhere to go, or something like just the need to sort of flee or not do what they're doing as he approaches. So they abandon their plan as he approaches them. They sort of one by one stand up, and he gets there and they fumble all over themselves, be like, you know, oh, well, let me hold your alms bowl. Well, let me wash your feet. Let me grab your robe. Please let me take care of you. And so he takes the seat that they'd prepared for them, And they, in an attempt to kind of figure out what he's learned or to get back in his good graces and struggling under this immense pressure of his spirit, they start to kind of pile on the praise. And they say to him, "Venerable Gautama, your skin is so bright. Your face is so round. You're like beads made of gold cast into the river." Like, you know, all of this just like really lavishing on the praise. And, but each time they repeat this idea, "Venerable Gautama, Venerable Gautama, Venerable Gautama." And that's what he hones in on. And he says to them, "Do not call me venerable," which amongst the ascetics, the word used means long lived. And so he says, "Do not call me venerable because I've found the path of immortality. And if you are stuck on the idea of a long life, you're not going to understand what I have to tell you." And that kind of rocks the ascetics back a bit. And so they seek to hear more of what he has to say, how he's gotten to the place that he is. And, but he's finished this long journey. So they agree to kind of stop and they, you know, care for the Buddha and set up a proper space for him to speak. And he does. They bring him back. He bathes in the river. They bring him back and they set him up on this stump to speak to them. And when he did, it says that all of the gods and the great beings attended the Deer Park sermon. And that the sutra actually says that the moment of ordainment for these five ascetics was as he starts to speak, as he starts to lay out what we now know is the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, as he starts to lay all of this out, he begins to glow with a light that is so intense that all beings realize that they are not alone, that there are other beings there that have feelings and, you know, are complete people. And he's laying all this out in the sutra, says that this is his discussion is so powerful that this is the moment of ordainment for these five ascetics. And again, this is a segment where there have been just an incredible amount written about what he said and how he said it and what came from his talk. And so I'm kind of going to gloss over that and return back to who these people were. Because what the thing that intrigued me about this, I originally was going to talk about, you know, the things that he said and how he laid out the Eightfold Path and all of that. But as I was going through it, I was just struck by these ascetics. And here in the woods, we have sitting on stump, the world Buddha, the enlightened Buddha of our time, attended by the great listeners, the great beings, the Brahma, the gods, the demigods, all of the world. And these third string students, these students who only a few hours before had called him lazy and gluttonous and were conspiring to have him make a fool of himself. These students that were not his first choice, not his second choice, but his third choice, are the ones present to hear this world-changing sermon, the first sermon of the Buddha of our time. And so the five men who were there, the five ascetics, were chosen in part because the Buddha knew them. He had practiced with them. He knew of their, one of the reasons he cites is their steadfast dedication to their practice, even though it was the wrong practice. They were going in the wrong way, but they were doing so wholeheartedly and with effort. He praised them for having sincerely studied what they believed was correct, and for being willing when he came to them, for being willing to share their knowledge, their practice, their space, their meager food with anyone who was interested in learning their practice. He was looking for someone who could go out and talk to just the people of the world and help them to understand something, who was willing to do that, who didn't have hangups about going to the lowest or the highest. And these five men were the first to be ordained by him because of their willingness to learn, their devotion to study, and I think in part because of the kindness that they showed the Buddha, or rather Siddhartha at the time when he came to them. And so I spent a while looking up the five men, these five ascetics who became the five arhats, the first five arhats, the first five ordained men, the ones who heard the Deer Park sermon. And of those five, really only two stand out in the records that we have today. Kundinya, there are a lot of different ways of writing these names. It makes kind of researching them a little bit difficult, but I settled on just one schema for it. But Kundinya was responsible for a number of writings that ended up in the sutras. One of the important things that he did was he taught to a person named Puna. And Puna himself was later responsible for bringing something like 500 new students to the Buddha. But Kundinya, all he did was teach this student. And then that student did something great. And then Kundinya decided that he traveled the world with the Buddha for many years. But the last 12 years of the Buddha's life, Kundinya decided that he'd kind of done all that he could. And so he basically left. He left the traveling party and went into the woods. And in the woods, he was, the sutra says that he had his needs tended to by a herd of 5,000 elephants, that they cared for him and took care of the things that he needed. And that the only time in the final 12 years, the only time Kundinya left his forest was to attend the Buddha's deathbed. The second most prominent of these five students, Asaji, was responsible for recruiting the two men who would become Buddha's chief disciples. And again, other than, you know, a verse in one of the sutras and some land that he had donated to him for a sangha space, that's kind of all that I could find out about Asaji. The other three men, who were Vapathera, Bahariya, and Mahanama, they all have a couple of verses in the sutras where they're talking to the Buddha that have been recorded, or something that they have said to a student is recorded. But there's very little about them. And like these are the first five men that he brought this teaching to. And aside from being core members of the Sangha, aside from being willing to share the Dharma, to teach it to anyone who asked, to bring students who wanted to know more, like that's the sum total of the great deeds that I could find of them, right? They brought in students, they received a land donation, they made friends with an awful lot of elephants. But here we are 2,000 years later, we have records of all of these students, and these five have kind of faded away, right? And so I think what I was saying and what drew me to this is that they seem to have been exceedingly average people. They had a devotion to what they were doing. They had a desire to learn. They were willing to teach others. And when they learned the truth, they wanted to share it. But they didn't become chief disciples. They didn't build magnificent temples. They didn't perform miracles. Just, they were good students. They were good teachers. They were good disciples. They were chosen. I've said this a couple of times, but they were chosen because of that willingness to learn, because of that dedication, because of the willingness to teach, and because when a young man came to them asking for their help to be taken in among them and taught what at the time they all believed was the way to truth, they took him in with kindness and helped him to learn the ways. And at this point, it's, I don't know. I guess I start thinking about like where I fit in terms of relationship to the teaching and disciples and things like that. And I don't know. I guess I'm pretty unlikely to have a bunch of land donated to me. Probably less likely to have a herd of elephants build my funeral pyre. But other than that, I kind of fit in. I don't know. I'm probably pretty likely to be somebody's third choice for something. I can share what I know. I am willing to practice wholeheartedly on the path that I'm on. I'm willing to offer kindness to the people who want to share my walk on this path. And I don't know, I guess where I settled on the end of it is maybe that is all that I need to be here with you guys in our Sangha, 2000 years later, just another student of the World Buddha, in a place where his most recent students among us are just as important as the things that those first five students did out in the world, which was to teach, to share, to offer kindness, and to bring in others who are interested in learning. And that's where my path through this sermon took me. So I hope that, I don't know, maybe it resonated with you guys. Maybe it brought you something interesting. So I will thank you very much for listening to me. And open it up for questions if anyone has them or discussion.
Okay. Would you be willing to drag our microphone?